If I talk like this? Okay. I am completely delighted to be here this morning and to have so many of you here. Thank you for all the people who have been coming up and saying hello and giving me a hug and giving me all that good energy. It's really wonderful every time to teach at Spirit Rock. And I look forward to getting to know those of you that I don't know yet. I'm going to say a few words as background and platform for the day before we begin with the opening meditation. So today, the focus is on compassion for self and for others. And basically, we're looking at the experience of being moved and being touched by pain and suffering, whether that's our pain and suffering or those of people around us. And it's feeling the flow within us going out of kindness and tenderness and care and concern for the experiencer of the suffering, whether that's us or other people. Sorry. And then also compassion always involves wise action to alleviate the suffering. It always involves a movement to relieving the conditions of the suffering. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, compassion is a verb. When it comes to our own compassion practice, I'm going to focus on three major elements of it. One is mindfulness, and if we're here at Spirit Rock, we have a value of mindfulness and paying attention to what's happening and our reactions to what's happening. And then the self-compassion, which is an acceptance of what's happening and an acceptance of our reactions to what's happening, which can open us up to compassion and the common humanity, which is taking wise effort in response to what's happening and even to our reactions to what's happening. I'm teaching this morning mindfulness and compassion and self-compassion out of this Dharma tradition here at Spirit Rock. But there's also a lot of research being done now about compassion, and it's really very, very exciting that the behavioral scientists and neuroscientists are validating what we know from our own experience and from our own study and practice. So much of the research that supports the effectiveness of mindfulness and compassion is coming out of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds, which is Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And Richie's been doing research for the last 20 years that shows that mindfulness and compassion are two of the most powerful agents of brain change known to science. So it's very exciting that the data is coming in to support what we experience. The Center for Mindful Self-Compassion at UC San Diego is supporting the work of Kristen Neff, who's now at the University of Texas at Austin, and Chris Germer, who's at Harvard. And Chris and Kristen developed Mindful Self-Compassion as a formal 8-week training program. And Kristen's research has shown that self-compassion is more powerful than self-esteem to help people recover a sense of well-being. The Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, CCARE, which is at Stanford, was funded originally by the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. And it is offering trainings in compassion in the Tibetan tradition. Mm-hmm. And the Dalai Lama has said that kindness is my religion, or my religion is kindness. So trying to very much to bring that into the Western world. And then the Greater Good Science Center, which is here at UC Berkeley, and that's Dacher Keltner and Emiliana Simon-Thomas. And they're doing what they call research into the science of a meaningful life. So that includes compassion, altruism, forgiveness, generosity, all of those kind of behaviors. So I'm drawing on what these researchers are telling us about compassion practice, as well as my own experience and study of compassion in this tradition. So I want to say a little bit about my journey, hopefully that it's relevant in whatever I'm trying to transmit today. I do like this quote from Lorraine Hansberry. One cannot live with sighted eyes and feeling heart and not know the miseries which afflict the world. So as we try to use our mindfulness and compassion together, we are opening to the misery that afflicts the world. So, and I hope everyone has a handout there on the back table if you don't have them yet. So I've been a psychotherapist in private practice for about 20 years, and a lot of what I do is help people recover from the impact of stress and trauma. I've also been a meditation teacher now for about 10 years, and I love this quote from one of my teachers here at Spirit Rock. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. That's really what we're trying to do when we study and practice compassion. I've been studying neuroscience for about the last 12 years, and neuroscience illuminates which tools we can apply that will be the most effective in using mindfulness and compassion tools to create brain change, to shift our functioning, shift our behaviors. And then the Mindful Self-Compassion Training, I met Kristen Neff 2 years ago now at a conference in Seattle. We were both presenting. And we met in the hallway, and we never even sat down. We talked for an hour and a half. There was just so much to say about mindful self-compassion. And at the time, I was especially interested in the power of mindful self-compassion to deal with the inner critic and self-judgment and shame, which are the biggest derailers that we have of resilience. Now I'm doing a lot more teaching and training of mindful self-compassion and of resilience. So there are flyers on the back table for the Deepening Joy groups that I'll be leading again this winter and the mindful self-compassion training that I'm offering again this winter. And I was going to say one thing about a piece of training that I did just recently. So Sunday, I came back from Jerusalem. I had spent a week there teaching at a conference that was sponsored by the Crisis Center for Religious Women. And the conference was on domestic violence and sexual abuse in the Orthodox religious community. So I was working with about 400 therapists and social workers and rabbis and lawyers trying to help women who are dealing with violence and abuse in the home in a community that's extremely reluctant to acknowledge and talk about those issues in the larger context of where people live in fear and terror of terrorism and war pretty much every day. So what I was trying to offer is some of what I'll be teaching today, the techniques of mindfulness and self-compassion that allow us to pay attention to what's happening, our reactions to what's happening, and to be able to respond wisely. And at the end of the second workshop, the conference organizers asked participants to come up with their action steps, what they would take back with them to their agencies and their private practice. And the unanimous vote was for self-compassion, for clinicians to be able to have compassion for themselves when they're dealing with very, very difficult material in a difficult context. And one of the participants said that self-care is client care. So hopefully that's some of what we'll be learning today. Part of why I think mindful self-compassion is so powerful is that it really does shift brain functioning, and we can experience that. It shifts how our brain is functioning in the moment so that we can recover our equanimity and our equilibrium. It shifts how our brain functions over time, and it actually creates new patterns of behavior, new patterns of response to the suffering in the world. And then eventually, mindful self-compassion or mindful compassion becomes a way of being. It becomes our natural way of responding to the events of our lives, and it becomes more effortless. So that's part of the power of what we're learning today. So I'm going to lead us in the opening meditation, and then I'll put the slide up about it. So this is a tool. This day is an experiential day because the brain learns and rewires from experience. We'll be doing a lot of new experiences to shift the functioning of our brain. It's important that you have self-compassion for yourself and respect your own comfort zone. So if anything I lead you in doesn't feel comfortable, you're very, very welcome to sit and listen and observe and take your notes. But if you are willing to do the exercises, then you're more likely to experience the functioning of your brain shifting over time. So we'll find a posture of sitting comfortably and quietly. I'm going to sit down for the meditations. That's how I can make it through the day. Become aware of your body sitting in the chair. Your seat and back against the chair or in the cushion, feet on the floor. Bringing your awareness to your own breathing, the gentle flow of breathing in and breathing out. You can take a few slow, deep breaths to release any tension that you might be holding. And then find your breath wherever it is the most apparent to you. Your nostrils or your throat, or the rising and falling of your chest or your belly. If your mind wanders, gently bring your attention back to your breathing again, like you would call back a beloved child or a puppy. And simply focus again on the sensations of your breathing. Incline your attention gently toward your breathing with openness and tenderness and curiosity. Let the body breathe itself. And notice how the breath naturally nourishes and soothes the body. See if you can feel your whole body breathing. The rising and falling of the breath, a gentle motion in your body, like the rising and the falling of a gentle sea. Allow your body to be gently rocked by the breath, like the breath is holding you like you would hold a child. Feeling the nourishing and the soothing of the movement of your breath. Give yourself over to the breath. Let yourself become the breath. Let the breath breathe you. And then take a moment to savor the stillness in your body. When you're ready, you can gently, slowly open your eyes. So the instructions for affectionate breathing are in your handout. The idea behind the practice is simply to bring a warm, caring, loving presence toward your own experience of being alive and being in your body. So we'll do another exercise simply to get a little more into the felt sense of what a mindful self-compassion practice can feel like. If you'll put down your papers and close your fists and squeeze them tightly, and then just share out loud whatever words might express that you're feeling when your fists are like this. What does this feel like?
Tension.
Constriction.
Anger.
Sadness. Fear.
Defended.
Tight.
Hard.
Closed. Strained. Panicked. It's true that our physiological state can affect our emotional state. So if you slowly, gently open your palms so that your hands are turned upward. And what does this feel like now? Open. Calm.
Playful.
Joyful.
Playful. Vulnerable.
Receptive. Yeah. Light.
Afraid.
Surrender. Now, reach your arms out a little bit so you're extending your hands forward. What does that feel like now?
Giving.
Welcoming.
Receiving.
Aware.
Vulnerable.
And now put one hand over the other on your heart center so that you can feel the warm touch of your hands on your heart. And what does that feel like now?
Thankful.
Soothing.
Kind.
Loving.
Safe.
So if we do that once again, we're going through the trajectory of using a mindful self-compassion practice. When we're fists are tight, we're contracted, and there's usually tension, and we're usually in our lower brain. And when we open our palms into a kind of mindfulness, awareness, receptivity, things start to feel open and spacious again. When we reach out, we're connecting with common humanity, that all human beings are vulnerable to the conditions of being human. And when we put our hands on our heart, that's the self-compassion, that's the tenderness, that's the care that allows us to feel safe and soothed so that we can meet the events of our lives wisely. Okay, I'm going to tell a story here. Any questions or comments or reflections before I go deeper into the day? Are we doing okay? And we do have someone to run the mic. Okay. Wait till the mic comes around.
I actually do not feel that progression. Mm-hmm. It's like I put my hands on my heart, I feel more sad.
You know, if you feel sad, so the whole practice is to be with what is and to accept what is and to accept ourselves in that moment. So if you're feeling sad and you have some awareness and some kindness toward the sadness, that's the compassion. That's how the compassion begins to flow. Is actually being able to be with whatever is. We're not pushing it away. We're not running away from it. So it's a perfect gateway to compassion practice. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Okay. So I'm going to tell you a story of where I began to experience myself the power of self-compassion to shift things, and then I'll put the slide up about it. So one day I was walking to work. I used to have an office in San Francisco. So I park my car every day in Golden Gate Park and then walk two blocks to my office. And I was worried about something. This is a walk I could do on automatic pilot. But I was worried about something. I had a decision to make. I wasn't quite sure what to do. And I wasn't paying attention to where I was going. So I stepped into a sidewalk of freshly laid wet cement up to my ankles. And the whole cascade starts. You klutz, look what you've done. You've ruined your shoes, you've ruined your day, now you're going to have to cancel clients, you're going to lose your income, your life's going to go down the tubes. I mean, the whole thing. And for once, I caught it. I was standing there in the cement going, wait a minute. I am really tired of beating myself up every time I make a mistake. I'm not the only person on the planet that made a mistake today, and this is probably not the only mistake I'm going to make today. So I need to have some care and compassion about myself here. I need to shift my perspective. And so I got out of the sidewalk. I pulled my shoes out of the sidewalk. And there was an apartment building with an outdoor faucet, so I was washing off my shoes. And I thought, you know, yeah, shit happens. Life is happening to me this way in this moment. But shift happens too. And I can change my attitude. I can open up to what this is. And the construction workers then came over with some paper towels for me to wipe off my shoes. And I realized if I can shift my attitude in this moment, I can shift it any moment at all. And that's the big realization of a mindful self-compassion practice, that we can shift our attitude any moment that we need to, any moment at all. So here's the story of that particular story. It's important to realize that we have a choice. As Julia Butterfly Hill says, every moment brings a choice and every choice has an impact. Everything we choose to do to shift our perspective allows us to be more compassionate and more wise in our responses. So this story, this quote from Viktor Frankl is probably very, very well known. Between a stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. The last of human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. So certainly Viktor Frankl went through much more difficult circumstances in Auschwitz than I went through in my sidewalk of freshly laid wet cement. When I was in Jerusalem, I went to Yad Vashem, which is a Holocaust memorial, and saw the photographs, of course, of people in Auschwitz and other concentration camps, other death camps, and the forced marches. And there was a quote there also from Viktor Frankl. When he was on a forced march from one concentration camp to another, he thought of his wife. Didn't know if she was still alive or not, but thought of her, thought of their relationship, thought of their love, and he was flooded with a sense that love is what we're about. And that is partly how he survived Auschwitz and went on to do all his work after that. So when we can open in a moment to love, compassion, care, kindness toward ourselves, toward other people, it's what allows us to shift and do more than even survive. It's what allows us to be wise in our efforts. So I'm going to offer this trajectory of how we combine mindfulness and self-compassion. So in our mindfulness practice, we know that we pause and we become aware. We become present to whatever is happening in the moment. So we come out of denial, we come out of dissociation, we come out of distraction, we're engaged with whatever the experience is in the moment. If we can notice and name the experience, then we're bringing some loving awareness to the experience. And one of the beautiful things that happens when we do that is it keeps the higher brain online so that we're not caught in our survival responses. When we can notice and name our experience, we're actually able to reflect on it. If in that moment we can have the moment of self-compassion, ouch, this hurts, this is painful, and I care. May I be kind to myself in this moment. I'll fix the problem in the next moment, but in this moment, may I be kind to myself. And what that does is it allows us to step back and reflect on the experience. We're no longer so entangled in it, and we can tolerate looking at the experience for what it is. So that's the door that self-compassion opens. We can tolerate whatever the experience is. Then, as my friend Janet Friedman says, we can catch the moment and make a choice, and we can shift to a wise view or wise action. So that's kind of how it flows over and over and over again. What mindfulness and compassion do together is they activate the caregiving system, which is what pulls us out of our threat response. So with mindfulness, we can focus on the experience of the moment. May I accept this moment exactly as it is? That's the core of mindfulness practice. May I accept this moment exactly as it is? With self-compassion, we're focusing our kindness on the experiencer, that we're having this experience. May I accept myself exactly as I am in this moment? We're not beating ourselves up for whatever's happening, our responsibility for what's happening, our reaction to what's happening. Just may I accept myself in this moment. And that activates the caregiving system. It activates the release of oxytocin in the brain so that we can shift from survival responses and contraction of the lower brain to actually being more open and engage with our experience again. So when we can use mindful self-compassion to activate the caregiving system, I care about myself, may I be kind to myself, it releases oxytocin, which is the hormone of safety and trust. It is the brain's direct and immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. So it is what allows us to restore a physiological equilibrium. We can actually come back to a sense of calm in our body. When we do that, then our mind, our brain is available to think things through again. There's a lot of research now that shows that compassion practice, more than many other practices, also creates what's called a left shift in the brain. And that simply means that when we're in our survival responses in our lower brain, we're also a little bit more in the right hemisphere of the brain, which has a tendency to avoid and withdraw from experience. Positive emotions create a left shift in the brain. There's more neural activity in the left hemisphere of the brain. And for evolutionary reasons, the left hemisphere is more open to experience. It's more open to learning. It's more open to growth and change. So anything we can do to shift the functioning of the brain to the left hemisphere, we're going to be more able to be open and engage with our experience. And compassion practice, they can see in the fMRI scanners, creates that left shift. Compassion is one of the most researched and documented of the pro-social emotions. So they know that that happens with a compassion practice. And from that, we can get into a larger perspective. We can reopen to common humanity. We can engage with other people again. We can get resourced again. And then we're much more able to respond wisely to what's happening. So we can practice this as we go throughout the day. It's very, very useful to take a self-compassion break as we go throughout the day. We pause and we notice, oh, is there any suffering here? Is this a moment of suffering? And taking the time to be able to say, ouch, this hurts, this is painful. And then often to be able to offer ourselves a soothing touch on the heart center or on the cheek or giving ourselves a little hug, or if you massage the back of your neck where the spinal column comes into your skull. It's loaded with oxytocin receptors there. So anytime we can do this warm, soothing touch, we're also activating the caregiving system. Then we bring the caregiving and kindness toward ourselves. May I be kind to myself in this moment. May I accept this moment exactly as it is. I went through this morning when I forgot my power cord. May I be kind to myself. May I accept this moment exactly as it is. May I accept myself in this moment exactly as I am. And that is the crucial turning point of a self-compassion practice. Then may I give myself all the compassion I need to respond in this moment wisely. So this is something, if you practice this 5 or 6 times a day, it begins to be a more automatic habit of how you're responding to events in the moment. So all of this that we're doing this morning is how we use a mindful self-compassion practice to shift our functioning, our response in the moment. Let me see what I'm doing next. Really? That was faster than I expected. Right. I'm sorry, I can't hear. Can you give us an example of how you shift your thoughts or actions? So the question is, can I give an example of how we shift our thoughts or our actions in the moment? By paying attention, that's one shift. Just paying attention to what's happening is a shift. And then opening to what is, just an acceptance of what is, not running away, not pushing it away, not being flooded, but just accepting this moment. And then that's another shift. Then focusing on myself. What's going on with me Am I okay? Am I grounded? Am I centered? Am I flustered? Am I angry? Am I frightened? What's going on with me? That's another shift. And then choosing to be kind to myself in that moment. May I know that I'm safe. May I be free of fear. May I be kind to myself in this moment. That is a shift. That shifts us physiologically. It shifts what's going on in the body brain. And from there, we can take a few moments, we can breathe, we can give ourselves the care. Our higher brain comes back online. Oh, I can reflect on this. I might have some choices here. And we can begin to look for some options for our wise action. Okay. So that's how we create the shift over and over and over again. Yes, Laura.
In that moment where you want to give yourself...
Okay, can you wait for the mic?
In that moment where we want to give ourselves kindness, mm-hmm. Can you say something about if you're really struggling with the belief that you don't deserve kindness, that you're not worthy of that?
Right. So the question is about feeling not worthy of kindness or care or compassion. I've done a lot of work with shame. And so we know that shame, the feeling inadequate, not worthy, unacceptable, a mistake, a failure, can't do anything right, nobody loves me, that whole territory derails our capacities to cope more than anything else, even more than fear. It derails our capacity to cope. So the self-compassion is the antidote to that. The belief system gets going. Here I am in my stories. They're so powerful. They feel so real. They've been true all my life. May I have compassion for myself that I'm so caught in that, that I feel the pain of being beat up by my inner critic so often. That's hard. That's painful. Now, that's the first shift in the moment. Eventually, the practice deepens, and we have compassion for the inner critic that's doing the best it can to protect us from danger and rejection and hurt and humiliation, and it's doing its job the only way it knows how to. So we have compassion for that part in us that doesn't want us to be hurt or humiliated, and we can thank it for the job that it's done so faithfully all these years and say that was one tool in the toolbox and we now have 20. But the compassion is still part of revising that belief system. How painful it is to carry that belief system and having compassion for that. Probably if you heard a friend beat themselves up the way you beat yourself up, you would just immediately, oh, don't be so harsh on yourself. It's not that bad. You know, you would immediately have compassion for them. So we just, there's a lot of fear around practicing self-compassion, but the idea of breaking through that belief system that we deserve care is probably one of the biggest turning points of that. And even part of the Buddha's teachings, when he's teaching about loving kindness practice and compassion practice, there is no one on earth more deserving than you of these practices, of these wishes for kindness and happiness and well-being. There's no one that deserves this more than you. But we don't always feel that from our conditioning. So we sometimes have to bring a lot of compassion to our intention to bring compassion. Okay. Yes, please.
Hi. I'm kind of struggling with, I've had the experience of being able to have some compassion, like with one moment. Mm-hmm. Like what you were describing with making a mistake, but I'm kind of struggling with like having compassion toward habits of being right now, like character defects where mm-hmm. That are sort of in some ways self-defeating or self-destructing and like not being ready to like trying to work through them, but still they just keep coming up, like procrastinating mm-hmm. and like, mm-hmm. like that kind of thing right now is really hard for me. Like how do I have compassion mm-hmm. when there's this, I'm caught in this cycle of, you know, procrastinating on this project or something. And then like, I, you know, it's like, I've had the moment where I miss a train and I'm like, oh my God, my day's ruined. And then I'm like, wait a minute, no, reset. It's okay. But like this like habit of mind right now, I'm getting caught in these bad patterns is like the next, you know, the second arrow is coming in all the time with like, oh my God, I'm never going to work through this procrastination thing. And I'm going to be out on the street and like,
So I'm going to answer that in two ways. It's very interesting that you're talking about procrastination because I did an article for Greater Good Science Center on how self-compassion alleviates procrastination. So that's some of the research that's coming in, that when we can be not so afraid of making a mistake because we're kinder to ourselves, even if we do make a mistake, then we can stop procrastinating because it doesn't matter if we make a mistake. So it's part of that trajectory. This morning, I'm talking mostly about how we can use self-compassion to shift in the moment. After we come back from the break, I'll talk about a lot of tools and techniques we use to change the patterns over time so that we're creating new habits and new responses to the old habits over time. So we'll be spending the rest of the morning learning how to do that. Okay. Other, yes, please. Wait for the mic.
You used one word and you mentioned being flooded. Could you talk about that a little more?
The threat system in our body brain tends to go in one of two directions. We'll either go into fight, flight, freeze, right? So we're activated to move towards something or away from something. Or our nervous system can shut down completely. If we're going to get overwhelmed and flooded, we just collapse, and then we're not available to deal with anything. So we have to watch out both for kind of running away and getting flooded and then collapsing. There's somewhere in that we're not in our equilibrium. So the self-compassion deals with any of those innate survival responses and brings us back to a core physiological equilibrium, which in this tradition we would call equanimity. But it's a physiological state that we can feel in our body, and then we can think again. And what brings us back to that state the fastest is the caregiving system. The, oh, sweetheart, I care, the soft touch. That's what brings our body brain back the most quickly. Yeah, yeah. In the back, please.
So one of the things you mentioned was felt sense, which to me is something that I think we can cultivate before we even get to the point of being self-compassionate. Mm-hmm. Can you, I guess, talk a little bit more about how to develop the ability to connect with that felt sense before the story kicks in?
Yes. So actually the next exercise I'm going to have us do before the break is to do that. It's how to get a felt sense of being grounded and present in the body. Even before we're thinking, figuring anything out, if we can be in the body, usually we're safe in the body. So if we can feel the felt sense of being in the body, we give ourselves a little space, a little bandwidth to remember, oh, I could do self-compassion here. And then once we remember to do it, the whole trajectory starts. So part of it is simply, some of you know this, Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now. The full title is Remember, Be Here Now. The remember is the key. So to remember to do the self-compassion is the key. And we can do that partly by grounding in our own body. So we'll do that just in a couple minutes before the break. Any other? Yes, please. Wait for the mic.
Thank you. Does your research tell you that the self-compassion break works to the extent of any level of pain and suffering, or is there some pain and suffering that is so deep it goes beyond the floor at to which self-compassion is effective?
I'll answer that in two ways. I thought of this phrase this morning. One of my main teachers, James Barras, teaches this, and I love the language of it. that which is aware of fear is not itself afraid. And the idea is that awareness is always larger than the fear or the sadness or the grief or anything that we might be experiencing. And I realize that self-compassion is one of the few things that is bigger than anything else. When we can have compassion and kindness and care for the suffering of the moment, it is bigger than the suffering of the moment. And I think I really felt that when I was in Jerusalem last week and working with clinicians who could use the self-compassion practice to get to a perspective that was large enough to hold not just an individual client that they're working with or a difficult week, but maybe the last 30 years of war in Israel. And so self-compassion is simply one of the most powerful tools that we have. And part of why I'm teaching it is, yes, it's big enough to hold anything. Yeah. Yes, please.
Hi. I think I have a sense of this, but maybe you could elaborate a little bit on the difference between self-compassion and self-pity.
Basically, self-pity leans toward disrespect or contempt, and self-compassion leads toward respect and love. Now, that's a very oversimplified way of saying it, but self-pity has a flavor of, oh, poor thing, or poor me, whereas the self-compassion has a sense of worth and deserving and bringing kindness and care to that, whether it's to ourselves or to other people. So it really leans more in the direction of love. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so, yes, there is. Okay, thank you.
In the process of deep grieving, where
wave after wave comes, how
yes.
do you...
Then you're simply using self-compassion to hold wave after wave after wave. One of the things that Kristen teaches is we don't practice self-compassion to feel better. We practice it because we feel bad. And, oh, that was another part of the response I was going to make over here. Can self-compassion hold anything? I don't know if people know Kristen's story, but she began her research into self-compassion when her son Rowan was diagnosed with autism. And because being the mother of an autistic son was so difficult and so painful when he would tantrum in public and there was nothing that she could do, and to have compassion for herself first, to put her own oxygen mask on first, and then to be able to deal with her son, that's how she got into the field, was having to deal with something that difficult. And now the research is showing that self-compassion as a process helps us deal with any of the content. But that includes grief. And when there's wave after wave after wave of grief, and simply, may I accept this moment, may I accept myself. And it's the acceptance that allows us to hold and move through the grieving. Because then it doesn't matter how big it is or how long it takes. The compassion is enough to hold it. Maybe one last question, if there is one. Yes, over here, Natalie.
Could you talk a little bit about the edge of, for me, when I notice an emotion and then I move into acceptance, there's this edge almost of suppression. It's like, oh, that's okay. And it kind of holds it in.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're kind of trained in our culture to hold it in. It's not so bad. I'm all right. I'll just move on. And that's not what self-compassion is. Self-compassion allows it to be there fully so that we're not resisting or pushing away any part of it, because the resistance creates more suffering. When we can fully be open, and, you know, part of it may be the common humanity piece of allowing us ourselves to know that other people suffer like this too, and to receive the compassion from other people for our suffering, which we'll do later this morning. After a while, we actually begin to experience and we begin to believe I can be with this. I can handle this. I'm not going to get overwhelmed. I'm not going to get flooded. I can do this. And that sense of competency that comes means we no longer have to be afraid of anything. We have a practice big enough to hold it. Yeah. So I'm going to... it's interesting the way the material is flowing in this workshop. I have shorter sessions at first and then a break and then a longer session, both this morning and afternoon, not sure. But I'm going to ask you to stand up and do an exercise and then we'll take our break. So this is an exercise also from Mindful Self-Compassion Training to make sure that we're grounded, that we're in our bodies. We're not in our heads or we're not dissociated. We're actually in our body. And so we're going to do this here, but then if you want to continue it on your break, there's a way to do that. So you simply feel the sensations of your feet on the floor. And you drop your awareness down all the way to your feet. And if you like, as I'm doing, you can rock your feet side to side or back and forward, which will change the sensations. And then you simply notice the sensations as they're changing in your foot. So now your awareness is in your feet. And if you wish, you can make small circles with your knees, which will also change the sensations in your feet. And so you're simply paying attention to that. And then this would be the prelude to a walking meditation where you would actually lift your foot and place it back down, lift the other foot and place it back down. And as you begin to do that, shifting from side to side, you can notice this tremendous burst of sensations in your feet. So you're anchored and grounded in your awareness of your body, in your feet. And anytime you're going through life and things become difficult and you get a little disoriented, you can just always do this. Awareness in the soles of your feet. Usually pretty safe to be there. Then you can offer a moment of gratitude to your feet because this little tiny square footage literally holds up your entire body and moves you through the world all day long. It's just completely miraculous that this can happen. So you have a moment of gratitude for your feet. So we are going to take our first break for 15 minutes. And I heard Sean say that the bathrooms in the trailers may be to reserve for women because it usually takes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.